Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, from the Sun Sound Studios in Flagstaff. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. How small habits can lead to big benefits. Research finds that subtle changes in our environment and the social cues we receive from other people can change the course of our lives. By Hope Reese, April 2, 2025. We often focus on what we can do individually to change our lives and improve our futures through our own willpower, choices, and internal narratives. But according to Gregory Walton, a professor of psychology at Stanford, our sense of self, our confidence, and even our relationships are shaped by the environments we move through and the way that others see us. In other words, places and people outside of us influence us more than we think. Walton has spent years of studying how subtle social cues, the way a teacher frames feedback, the way a partner approaches conflict, or the way a community signals belonging can shape a person's identity and future. He calls these tweaks wise interventions, small but strategic changes that can have a profound effect on motivation, learning, and resilience. In his new book, Ordinary Magic, Walton explores how small but powerful social forces influence everything from parenting to workplace culture to friendships. I spoke with him about how we can better understand the hidden dynamics shaping our lives, how small changes can help people feel like they belong, and how we can use those insights to foster better relationships at home, in school, and in our communities. Here's our conversation, edited for clarity. Hope Reese. The subtle ways we influence each other can go in a positive or negative direction. Can you explain that? Gregory Walton. Spiral up or spiral down is a way to understand how a process goes out of one system and into another. Say you're in a situation where you're asking an icky question like, "Can I trust you?" And then you start to behave in a certain way. That behavior is visible to other people, and they are responding to that. That starts these cycles that can either be positive or negative. For instance, say you feel a little bit insecure in a relationship. You're unsure if your partner is really committed to you. Then they're late again, and you think, "My fears are confirmed. They are not committed to me." You lash out even a little bit, or you hold back. That person sees that, and now they're dealing with a partner who's more difficult. But you can also spiral up. For instance, where there's a teacher and a student, and the teacher can see the good and competent student that student can become, even when they're getting in fights and they're not doing well in math class. They can hold up that image for the student. Hope Reese. Some interventions are unbelievably effective for relationships. Can you talk about these? Gregory Walton. I have an understanding of how these interventions work, but I also share the incredulity and astonishment at them. It goes back to the idea of spirals, and all a relationship is really is just that spiral between two people. I see you, and I have a certain thought or feeling, and then I manifest that in some way, and then you see how I'm behaving towards you, and you have thoughts, your thoughts and feelings, and you bring it back to me. When couples get caught in conflicts, the conflict itself is starting to imply a kind of broader negative meaning for the couple. Every little offense, every little problem becomes another sign of disrespect or lack of commitment. Finkel's 7-minute writing every 4 months is one example of an intervention where couples take a third-party perspective of someone who wants the best for all. Can both members of the couple find another way to see the conflict? Can they overcome the barriers that would prevent them from taking that into conflict situations? This intervention helps make conflicts more productive. Couples are less distressed when they have a conflict, and presumably they're more productive in dealing with it. There's also Karina Schumann's intervention on taking 5 minutes to think about what your big picture values really are before you engage in that conflict conversation. And it improves relationships a year later. Denise Marigold's compliment work is about the same process, where each member of the couple gets space to essentially feel the love that their partner has for them and be centered in that, and then go into the conflict conversation. And then it's just a completely different situation. You're productive. You actually can work out whatever the issue is. Hope Reese. There is one intervention that was shown to improve racial relations. Can you describe it? Gregory Walton. Research finds that cross-race friendships, even when they start at similar levels of closeness, degrade more quickly than same-race friendships. One process that might be contributing to that is the difficulty that both members of that friendship have in talking about differences that they have in, for example, their race-related experiences. Kiara Sanchez wrote a paper about black and white friends, talking about black friends' race-related experiences called A Threatening Opportunity. She found that both groups saw really valuable opportunities in having those conversations. Opportunities for mutual understanding, opportunities for greater closeness, but they also felt different kinds of threat in that. They had different kinds of worries. For instance, black friends were apprehensive that their experiences might not be taken seriously or understood, while white friends were apprehensive that they might say something wrong or be seen as insensitive or potentially racist. Both people are treating a certain space as a no-go zone. But then that space doesn't get known, and that's a barrier in the relationship. In her experiment, she developed a structured protocol for young adults who are Black and white friends to have a personal conversation with each other over Zoom. In the first case, it was a general personal conversation about something in the Black friend's personal identity and experience that they hadn't shared before. In the second case, it had to do with their racial identity or background or experience. And in the third case, it was similar to the second case, but both friends also did an exercise to think directly about the apprehension and anxiety that that topic can pose to both friends. It was a way to surface that these conversations can provoke anxiety sometimes, but to represent that anxiety as a sign of the friends' commitment to each other, their caring for each other, and their commitment to that relationship. And going to that place, that's a little bit more difficult because they care about each other. Everybody felt a lot closer afterward. But when Kiera tracked those friends over time in that third condition, when friends had been given the support to think through the anxiety that that topic poses and then had the conversation, those friendships stayed strong from the Black friend's perspective. They stayed just as close, and they felt more comfortable in having those kinds of conversations going forward, even 2 to 8 months later. Hope Reese. As far as interventions in the education space, what are some ways language can be used to support students when delivering feedback? Gregory Walton. The teacher can say to a student who did well, "Good job, you did well." There's research by Laura Park at the University of Buffalo showing that for women in math in particular, when a male instructor doesn't just give them a good score, but marks that score was good, that supports their experience of belonging. When a student hasn't done well, you can say, "I see that you haven't done well. I know that you can do better. I'm here to partner with you in your growth journey. Let me know how I can help." It's not about coddling. When you're clear about the questions that are on the table for somebody, you don't have to hold back in giving them critical feedback or telling them that they're not there yet. You can be very blunt and clear about that, but you can also tell them about your belief in their potential and the quality of that ongoing relationship that you have with them. "You did well. You worked hard at this, and I think you can do better. This is feedback to help support you." A lot of times we don't say these things. We imply them or we intend them, but we don't say them. Hope Reese. Telling students they're smart is actually hurting them, right? Gregory Walton. Right. The classic Claudia Mueller and Carol Dweck work on praise processes like, "Oh, you're so smart," shows that yes, that feels really good, but it creates this kind of collective environment where when you struggle at something or you fail at something, your genius is now at risk. That maybe you don't have it, maybe you never had it, or maybe it's running out. This doesn't equip you to be resilient. Hope Reese. And coddling has a negative effect, right? Gregory Walton. This is the long history of the self-esteem movement. You walk into elementary school classrooms, and still today, you see posters. You're number one. There's research that excessive, undeserved, non-contingent praise is bad and backfires for kids. For kids who are already kind and self-congratulatory, it breeds narcissism. For kids who are a little more modest, it can undermine self-esteem. It seems to produce the opposite of what it intends. The three-legged approach that Eddie Brummelman talks about is 1, unconditional regard. I love you no matter what. 2, honest feedback. Here's where you are. And 3, a growth mindset. Here's my belief in your potential to grow, and here's how I'm going to play my role in supporting that. That's what actually breeds healthy self-esteem and resilient kids. About the author. Hope Reese is a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, who writes for The New York Times, The Atlantic, Vox, and many other publications. Her book, The Women Are Not Fine, will be published in 2025. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. And next, we're going to go back to the Finkel's 7-minute writing every 4 months that was referenced in the previous article as a greater good in action practice. Gaining perspective on an argument. Think about conflict differently to improve your relationship. How to do it. Time required. 15 minutes several times a year for the formal practice. You can use perspective-taking skills whenever conflict arises with your partner. How to do it. It is easy to get wrapped up in our own heads when we argue with our partners. This exercise will help you to gain some perspective on your feelings during conflict. Think about a major disagreement that you had with your partner in the past 4 months and how much distress it's still causing you. Then follow these steps. Number 1, think about this disagreement with your partner from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for all involved. A person who sees things from a neutral point of view. How might this person think about the disagreement? How would they view your partner's behaviors and perspective? How might they find the good that could come from it? And this should take about 5 minutes. Number 2, some people find it helpful to take this third-party perspective during their interactions with their romantic partner. However, almost everybody finds it challenging to take this third-party perspective at all times. In your relationship with your partner, what obstacles do you face in trying to take this third-party perspective, especially when you're having a disagreement? What might help you to overcome them? For example, if you find yourself getting caught up in the heat of the moment, it might help to pause and take a deep breath. And this part takes about 5 minutes. Number three, despite the obstacles to taking a third-party perspective, people can be successful in doing so. Over the next 4 months, try your best to take this third-party perspective during interactions with your partner, especially during disagreements. How might you be most successful in taking this perspective in your interactions with your partner over the next 4 months? How might taking this perspective help you to make the best of disagreements in your relationship? And this should take 5 minutes. Allow these reflections to inform your interactions with your partner over the coming months. Why you should try it. Fighting and arguing can introduce a lot of negativity into romantic relationships, as one person's criticisms and accusations may be met with defensiveness and angry retaliation. The quality of the relationship may decline, which can harm mental and physical health. During arguments, some of our emotional pain comes from the evaluations we make about our partner's behaviors and intentions. But these evaluations aren't always correct. The technique of emotional reappraisal can help us reinterpret emotionally charged events in more accurate, positive, and constructive ways. For example, we might feel that a partner who cancels dinner repeatedly doesn't respect us, but remind ourselves that he's overburdened at work now and shows care and respect in other ways. Of course, we don't want to use this practice to excuse or rationalize unacceptable behavior, but in the context of a generally healthy partnership, it can help to lessen negative feelings, build connection and empathy, and ultimately improve the relationship. Why it works. When we experience conflict with others, we typically take a first-person perspective, concerned with our own thoughts, feelings, and values. This practice invites us to adopt a third-person perspective, the perspective of an observer who sees both partners' points of view and wants to achieve the best resolution for everyone. When we do this, research suggests we also reduce the anger and distress that we're feeling. Rather than responding out of indignation or pain, we can act from the desire to see our partners and ourselves be happy and connected. Reflecting in advance about how to implement these strategies and what obstacles we might encounter makes us more likely to succeed. Evidence that it works. A group of heterosexual married couples practiced gaining perspective on an argument every 4 months for a year. In the year before the experiment, they had reported a decline in marital quality, their sense of satisfaction, love, intimacy, trust, passion, and commitment in their relationship. But as soon as they began practicing, that decline stopped, while declines continued in a control group who didn't do the practice. These benefits were partly accounted for by the reduced distress they felt around conflict. Sources are Eli J. Finkel, Northwestern University. He and his colleagues wrote the paper in 2013, A Brief Intervention to Promote Conflict Reappraisal Preserves Marital Quality Over Time. And this was published in Psychological Science, volume 24, and pages 1595 to 1601. You have been listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, wishing you a wonderful rest of the day, and thank you so much for listening. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.